Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hey, Film Files, what's happening? Welcome back to the show. We're so glad you're back. How is everybody? Are you guys good? It's almost summer. Weather's getting warmer. I'm excited for today's episode. You already know what movie we're going to talk about if you clicked on this, but my excitement does not compare to that of our guest. Today was her movie choice. She picked The Phantom of the Opera from 2004, directed by the one and weird Joel Schumacher, written by Joel Schumacher and Andrew Lloyd Webber. And so to kick us off, I'm going to ask our guest and my lovely wife, Anna, to explain why is this movie worth talking about on the podcast?
Hi. Thank you for the warm welcome. I feel that it's important to note I chose this movie, one, for the girls and the gays, and two, because you've also never seen it, which was a big deal. It's very hard to find a movie that I have seen and you have not seen before. You have seen the musical version of it when the, like, with the Broadway traveling company.
Shout out to Peoria Civic Center.
There you go. So you were familiar enough with the story that you weren't going in totally blind, but the movie is a different experience than the musical stage performance. And also, I just really fucking loved this movie. I was the perfect audience for it. 2004 release. I was 15-ish years old. I was a music kid, and I had probably heard some Phantom music at some point, but not in this level. And it was very quickly enveloped into my life in a way that was, it's a fond memory. But I will say that as an adult, it's a very different viewing experience. And I now love this movie for very different reasons, which include the fact that it is pure fucking camp. And I know I said this episode was for the girls and the gays, but it's also for the boys who are down with some camp and aren't afraid of stereotypes. This is a great fucking movie. It is so much fun to watch. And we're going to break down why that's the case and why Andrew Lloyd Webber is the king of melodrama. And just like him and Joel Schumacher fully committed to the bit in a way that is
such a beautiful collab.
It was like such a perfect symbiotic relationship. And I'm so glad we got to see it happen in our lifetime. And yeah, welcome to the Phantom of the Opera episode of this podcast.
Yeah, Joel Schumacher is definitely one of my favorites growing up. He directed The Lost Boys. He directed Batman Forever, A Time to Kill. Yeah, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin. He always kind of leaves his Joel Schumacher stamp. And I feel like the collaboration between Andrew Lloyd Webber, who, first of all, the music in this movie, 10 out of 10, couldn't be any better. But his musicals, they don't always translate well to the screen, i.e. Cats. But like,
wait, hold on. I feel like we got to put a little bit of respect on the musical's name, because this movie wouldn't have existed if the musical hadn't been such a huge success. I don't want to go into this assuming that everybody knows Phantom of the Opera as it is, like such a big deal. I think people probably know the name of the musical if they haven't seen it in some capacity. But it is worth noting that this, The Phantom of the Opera, the musical itself, which was written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, is the second highest grossing musical of all time, right behind The Lion King. It ran on Broadway for 35 years, from 1988 to 2023, but it's still kind of always in operation somewhere. There's like a touring company of Phantom of the Opera, like officially licensed. And that's a big fucking deal for a Broadway show, a musical to go that long. Like, I mean, The Lion King had Disney's backing. Like, that's its own thing, and it's amazing as it is. But Phantom was stellar from the start, and it had such a big, loyal, and devout following, even from the beginning, as a musical theater production on Broadway. And it's been in London. It's had its residency in the West End. It's toured all over the United States. It's how I saw it. That's how you saw it. And so they made it very accessible as a musical theater production, which is kind of rare. It's getting more common. Like the big ones, Wicked's toured, Book of Mormon's toured.
But this was probably the first one.
This was probably one of the, yeah, exactly, the big first touring musicals. I think it's hard to understate how big of a deal it was as a musical in general.
Yeah.
Because it was 1988. Shit, I wasn't even born yet. This musical is older than me, which is really cool.
Yeah.
It's not older than you, though.
No, almost. 20 years. Maybe it's time we do Renaissance.
I would not at all be surprised because Andrew Lloyd Webber is still alive and kicking. And he did do Phantom of the Opera 2 came out, which is a really funny thing to say out loud. But I was in London when it was debuted on the West End. And I think that's where it debuted. I don't remember exactly. But I was in London and I had some peers who were very excited about it. And I was like, no, I don't really need to know. Like, I'm good with the way that it ended. It was perfect for me. I don't really need any more. But it's some very excited peers who went and saw it somewhere on the West End. There isn't great lore about Phantom of the Opera 2 where Andrew Lloyd Webber had written almost all of it and then his cat deleted it on his computer.
I have heard that. Of course he's got a cat.
Of course he does. He's Andrew Lloyd Webber. But it's important to note that if you go into this and you're not a musical theater person at all, to just like kind of generally orient yourself in the world of Andrew Lloyd Webber, and that is that, yes, he did Cats. He is the mastermind behind Cats, which I feel like we should talk about sort of as on like tangentially because holy shit, what the hell happened with that movie? That was the Animorphs movie of Cats. That shit was weird as hell. But he's also the man behind Evita, which was a movie that starred Madonna.
Mm-hmm. With no dialogue at all.
No dialogue at all. That's one of the things that Andrew Lloyd Webber was very popular for, was that he kind of took this operatic approach of super limited dialogue. It was all singing.
Yeah.
And you see that in musicals like Les Mis. Tom Hooper did Les Mis.
Yeah, right.
The movie adaptation. And Tom Hooper did the movie adaptation of Cats. So womp womp. There's something to unpack there.
Yeah.
But with Andrew Lloyd Webber, we just got to put a little bit of respect on his name. This is a man who's committed to the melodrama of music theater, and he financed the 2004 Phantom of the Opera movie. He was the producer behind it, and him and Joel Schumacher committed to working on this together like 14 years before it ever became what it is. Yeah. Like there were scheduling conflicts, and they had sold the rights to Warner Brothers, and then it was like a whole thing, and then it's one of those things where it's a miracle to get a movie to get made, and this is one of those situations. And you can share your criticisms of Andrew Lloyd Webber for sure. But Phantom of the Opera has a very loyal and wide and vast fan base. This is the man behind Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yeah, I mean, this movie made $100 million.
I mean, he has been in the musical theater game for a long fucking time.
Yeah.
And also Phantom of the Opera 2. I never saw it, but
yeah, I probably it was never called it. Love Never Dies.
Right.
Based off of the 1999 novel The Phantom of Manhattan.
Oh, made in Manhattan? Just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
Jenny from the Block. Yeah. So I wanted to put a little bit of respect on Andrew Lloyd Webber's name before we like jump into it, because I'm coming into this podcast for justice for this movie. It was critically panned. Justice for Joel. It was critically panned. And I'm coming in to say, I don't think that shit was warranted at all. Because he gave us what we needed. It gave what it needed to give. This movie is ridiculous and awesome, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, I think this is a really... I mean, I don't remember when this movie... Actually, I was working at Hollywood Video when this movie came out on video, and I don't remember it selling particularly well, but I think it's also probably a very misunderstood movie. This was in 2004. In 2001... Moulin Rouge came out and kind of like changed the way that a lot of...
2001?
2001.
Okay. So Baz Luhrmann paved the way for this movie.
Right.
But like Moulin... It's interesting because Moulin Rouge, I don't know what the critical reception was, but the Venn diagram of people who love Moulin Rouge and who love Phantom of the Opera is a single overlapping circle.
But it's very different attitudes. I mean, there's some characteristics, you know, like if you're going to talk about a musical adaptation, it's like... Do we talk about the music? Do we talk about the story as a movie? Because plays and musicals are just insane plots that you just have to accept. You can't like pick apart the plot per se of Phantom of the Opera, because any movie that you watch on a TV, whether it's an adaptation or whatever, it asks you to be a little more realistic about the things that you're seeing. But musicals inherently are fantasy.
It's because musical reasons. There's some things exactly. that happen that you're like, it's because musical reasons.
And I'm fine with that. I was a theater major. I really do like musicals. I saw Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. But yeah, Moulin Rouge.
I just want to say it also feels like a good time because we're having a bit of a musical renaissance in Hollywood. There was sort of a drought of true musicals like Broadway adaptations. And now we've got Wicked coming out. And I would not be at all surprised.
And Wonka.
And, well, Wonka was its own, like, whatever. Timothy Chalamet, whatever.
It was not, I mean, it was...
Chalamet.
Is it a musical? I think it's a musical.
But I'm talking about Broadway adaptations.
Oh, yeah,
specifically, yeah. Wicked just celebrated its 25th anniversary, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there's been some, like, hubbub, which, like, makes sense why it's coming out. But I think Hollywood kind of goes through these, like, cyclical phases where something makes a lot of money. Like Chicago, the musical that was directed by, I don't know, Rob Reiner?
No.
If I remember, if I'm right, I just want to never...
If
I want you to never forget that I was right just now. Catherine Zeta-Jones was 3 months pregnant while she filmed that movie. And she was a fucking star and she got an Oscar for it. Is it Rob Reiner?
So close. Rob Marshall.
Oh, damn it.
Damn, that's pretty good though.
Oh, not bad. Rob Marshall. Okay, so Chicago.
Who also did Into the Woods and Mary Poppins.
Okay, well, which Mary Poppins? Disney one?
Emily Blunt.
Okay, yeah, so that's fairly recent. Kind of did okay.
2018. But anyway, it did great.
Into the Woods was fun, but like we had like a spurt of Broadway adaptations where they were like, oh my God, these make money. And they like get critical acclaim and they like rush to do it. Phantom was a little early for it because Chicago, I think, was a little after. I think it was like 2006 or 2007. And then there were some like obvious like money grabs at it. Like there was like a Nine movie that was...
Rob Marshall did that too.
Oh, there you go. That tracks. I remember Nicole Kidman. It looked like it should have won everything and it did not. Phantom was unfortunately overlooked and critics were like, this movie did not, was stupid. And I disagree with them entirely. But anyway... We're at the point now where we're probably going to see a bunch of musical adaptations. I think Wicked will do really well. We've got Ariana. We've got Cynthia Erivo. And we've got just like a great cast of people. And we've got a super strong Glinda and Elphaba. So I wouldn't be surprised if we get like a Phantom redo. We can do our cast for that later. I wouldn't be surprised if we get like a Book of Mormon on the big screen because we never did. They never made that into a movie. But like Wicked is about to kick off something else.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
And it's probably going to be a Disney-led charge.
Maybe.
But this movie, Phantom of the Opera, I was already excited to talk about it just because, like Anna said, I had never seen the movie and I can find good in any movie. It's one of my useless superpowers. And this movie got a 33%. So it made
on Rotten Tomatoes.
On Rotten Tomatoes, which made me even more excited to watch it because...
Haters.
Knowing that it did so poorly, I was like, you know what? I'm gonna really like it. I'm gonna love it, and I'm gonna show those trolls. And it was great. I loved it. But the movie, it was $56 million budget, which is pretty impressive because this movie goes big, and it made $165 million.
Profitable queens.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
And so yeah, but I think this movie was just kind of underrated because like. There's some tonal dissonance going on that, like, you know, it didn't distract me. But if people went in expecting Moulin Rouge, I don't remember what the marketing for this movie was like. But it'll go from, like, you know, Joel Schumacher's, one of his calling card characteristics is, like, intentional camp. It doesn't always catch on as intentional.
I don't know if Joel Schumacher would call it camp, but that became his calling card.
I mean, Batman Forever is the silliest shit. I mean,
and I love that movie.
The Lost Boys.
Okay, fair. But he also does these like weird serious courtroom dramas.
He does.
So, like,
yeah.
He's got some fucking range. So, also some respect on Joel Schumacher's name.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying his movies are campy, but I'm saying his movies have a certain aesthetic and he does things
this
that
one
I
is
think.
Campy.
Yeah. And there's some campy moments and then it'll go to like deathly serious. It's, you know, there's some tonal shifts that, you know.
I disagree. I think this movie is like fully committed to its bit and its aesthetic the whole way through. And it delivers on that every single minute. There's some like occasionally some weird shots or some weird shit. And you're like, but it's like brief. And you like can maybe understand like what they were trying to do with it. But what I love about this movie, it is just like so opulent and so over the top from start to finish. And that is musical theater. And that especially because this one is a musical that takes place in a Parisian opera house in the early 1900s that like it should be all that glitters is gold. Like it should be sort of like, whoa.
Yeah. A showstopper from beginning to end.
And just so shiny and sparkly. And it also, that translates down into the Phantom's lair, which we can get into in a bit.
Oh my God, yeah.
But like this one is, as is the case in most Joel Schumacher movies, he's got a vision, he's got an aesthetic, and he's going to fucking go for it. And this one, I think it kind of translates on the screen as campy. And I mean that in the best possible way.
Yeah, intentional.
Like, I feel like it's important to define camp, what that means, because we don't mean like summer camp. And the word camp has kind of entered the lexicon like in a more obvious way since the Met Gala did the camp theme a couple years ago. But I pulled this camp definition from Wiki, which I think was contributed to by Vogue, which is, quote, where high art necessarily incorporates beauty and value, camp necessarily needs to be lively, audacious, and dynamic. The visual style is closely associated with gay culture. Camp art is related to and often confused with kitsch, and things with camp appeal may be described as cheesy. And I, like, watching this as an adult woman, I haven't seen Phantom of the Opera in a long, long, long time, like 10, 15, maybe 20 years. And watching it as an adult, kind of through this like adult lens, there's other thoughts that populate. But I was like, yeah, this is fully fucking committed to the bit. And it is so honest to like the sort of musical theater feel of it that I have a lot of respect for that. Because one of the things about Chicago is they like, yes, still the musical of the movie, but they like really stripped it down. There were some grand like chorus, like full chorus numbers, but they really tried to make it feel gritty. And Joel Schumacher was like, no, we're going to make this shit feel so over the top. Mm-hmm. And they did. Yeah. Every single scene.
It's why it feels like such a perfect collaboration, because they're both such incredible, prolific, renowned, talented, marketable artists, but they also dip into camp territory at times. And so for Joel Schumacher to be like, all right, Andy, write whatever you want. I will make it happen. They wrote the screenplay together. Andrew Lloyd Webber bankrolled it. And they were just like unapologetic about everything. So I think that even though the movie, you know, did make a lot of money, but it still was kind of critically panned, I think a lot of people probably thought these over the top campy moments were unintentional.
They were so intentional.
I agree.
Yeah. I don't know. It's tough to say because like, I saw the Traveling Broadway production and I was, of course, like very moved. And I saw the Traveling Broadway production after I saw the movie. I know that for sure. It was probably like right around the same time, because I'm sure the Traveling production like really kicked up their tour dates after the movie was released, because there's like this like renewed interest in the show. And it is a very grand musical. It's not small scale at all. You know, like Wicked is another one that's very big, but that's also very contemporary. And the music is very contemporary. And I don't know, I could go forever about musical theater. This is about the movie, The Phantom of the Opera. And we'll see how the movie for Wicked does. I think it's going to be great. But point is, it stayed very true to the musical theater sort of vision. I would think that there were some complaints from the musical theater version of The Phantom of the Opera on the casting, which we can get into, because it did certainly take like a Hollywood casting turn. And it's hard because that's going to happen. And anytime you adapt a musical into a movie, you're going to get complaints from the original Broadway cast that like the whoever you cast in the Hollywood version is not up to snuff. And usually they're not the same level of vocalists. They just aren't. For whatever reason, Hollywood casting agents don't want to cast Broadway people in the movie versions of the musicals. And who knows why that's the case. But I know there were some, like I remember online in the early stages of the internet, there were complaints about the woman main character of Phantom of the Opera. The character name is Christine Daae. And in the movie, she is played by young Emmy Rossum, who is now known for Shameless fame, among other things. And she was a trained opera singer with the Metropolitan Opera of New York. So she had the vocal chops. But did she have the vocal chops of the original Christine Daae, a.k.a. Sarah Brightman, who was the first woman to debut the character on Broadway? No. No, she didn't. It's just like two different... It's an orange... An apple's an orange.
Actor trained to be singer versus...
Yeah. But like, she could fucking sing. Emmy Rossum could fucking sing, and she did a great job. But there were just people who were like so upset about that. And there were a lot of people who were upset about the casting of the Phantom, which we can talk about. Because he did his best.
He did his best. So let's recast this thing. So they're going to remake this movie in our fantasy world, and they're going to have to recast the three main parts. So we're going to help out. We're going to give out some really good casting ideas. Oh. I have the three main ones I'm pretty proud of.
I want to hear yours.
All right. So the Phantom is going to be played by John Bernthal.
Oh, can he? Okay. So we're going into this like, we don't know if they can sing. Correct. We'll assume that they can get a vocal coach.
Well, Gerard Butler couldn't sing, and we made that happen.
Well,
so I think Gerard Butler,
John Bernthal, that's so hot.
That would be good because you need the balance of light and dark. He can be an asshole. He can be a hero. Christine, I mean, is there any other choice but Zendaya?
I actually have a contender who can sing. Rachel Ziegler or Ziegler. Oh. Who's the...
Thank you for not saying Sydney Sweeney, by the way.
Oh, no. I'm thinking like, well, I mean, Christine could be blonde. She could be brunette, whatever. I don't know if Rachel Ziegler, I don't know if I'm saying her name right. I don't know if she can sing at the range that Christine needs to because she is like a true operatic soprano.
We can get her there.
I mean, probably. She's good. Ariana DeBose is, I think, an alto, so I don't know if she would be the right choice. But there's some good singers coming out courtesy of the West Side Story. Well, we just had West Side Story, okay?
Oh, yeah. Who played Maria?
That was Rachel Ziegler.
Was it? She played Maria?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I also thought about Jenna Ortega, but that remains to be seen.
I don't know if she can sing at all.
She probably can't. For Raul, John Hamm 5 years ago.
I said when we were watching it, I said Jonathan Groff.
Yeah, Jonathan Groff would be pretty good.
So the age difference between Christine and her suitors is like 20 years.
Yeah.
I think Raul is supposed to be like in his mid-30s. The Phantom is supposed to be in his early 40s. I don't know how old Jonathan Groff is, but he could totally pass for his mid-30s, whatever age he is, no problem. And he has the vocal chops. I could not cast a Phantom in my head. It's got to be somebody like tall, dark, and handsome.
Oscar Isaac?
Maybe a little, little shorty Phantom.
Yeah, a little short king.
He could. I love it. Something to note about the Phantom is that he's supposed to be like ugly. He's never ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe because Gerard Butler was in tough company with this cast because everybody was so talented with their singing. I didn't think he did bad at all. I thought his singing was... So you compared him to the Russell Crowe of this movie, and I guess he is, but Russell Crowe, even somebody...
We got to clarify what that means, because if you've seen Les Miserables, Russell Crowe in Les Miserables is atrocious.
He did his best,
but he is truly atrocious. Yeah. And everybody who watches that, it doesn't matter if you're a musical person or not, you're like, oh damn, what is going on here?
Yeah,
he's just shouting at you the whole time. God, poor Russell Crowe. He really did do his best, but like,
good
but
for him for Russell like Crowe, stretching himself and putting him out there.
Yeah,
he didn't do a terrible job.
It makes it easier to hate him because he's a real piece of shit in the musical.
Yeah, but he was surrounded by Anne Hathaway and Hugh Jackman, so yeah, like, what the
I know,
fuck?
Especially because Hugh Jackman was his like big rival. He's like chasing him the whole time, and Hugh Jackman is an amazing vocalist and like a trained singer, and it's very clear. So Gerard Butler is the Hugh Jackman of the cast of Phantom, but he's not as bad as Russell Crowe was.
No, he's not.
He does bring a certain je ne sais quoi that's like rock and rollish, but he does not have the same vocal training as the rest of the cast, and that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But I think it works because the Phantom is kind of this like, I mean, he's this like weird fucking creep who lives in a basement of an opera house.
I thought he was kind of a bland... I mean, I know his character is dark and mysterious and he only has like 8 lines of spoken dialogue, but yeah, I didn't...
He sings a lot.
He does. He sings a lot. And I did feel bad for him at the end when he's crying, but...
He killed some people.
They do such a good job of making him this monster. I mean, both men kind of take away Christine's agency. I feel like the whole movie, she's not
a very proactive protagonist.
She's being just pulled back and forth. Gerard Butler's like, she's mine. And Patrick Wilson's like, she's mine. And she's just like, oh my God, who am I going to choose?
Well, there you go. This is a story written by a dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's based on a book, which, as most of these things are. And that's something I take issue with.
She's not a very strong character, I guess.
Well, she's supposed to be, quote unquote, like the main character. It's a love triangle between Raul, the Phantom and Christine, and Christine is supposed to choose between these two men. But like you said, like she gets things just keep happening to her, and she doesn't have any agency until the very end, where she has to make a decision. But she's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, like wouldn't so you be like, you know what? Fuck you both. I'm quitting.
Yeah,
I'm getting a job at Bennigan's.
Well, and like we don't need to go like I say this as a feminist. Like you don't need to go. I understand this was like the Paris Opera House in like the early 1900s. But she's literally just reacting to the things happening to her over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's a really annoying storytelling device, as is the case for any main character, no matter the gender, when they are literally just reacting to the things that are happening to them versus making choices that's driving the story forward.
Yeah.
And she's like literally being led through dungeons and then like led on rooftops. And yeah. like men are telling her, choose me. And she's like, maybe.
Yeah. The Phantom sings her a song and she's like, you're right, I do love you. And then Patrick Wilson sings her a song and she's like, oh shit, I do love you.
Yeah. So she's sort of a pawn until the very end. And even then she's like a rock and a hard place situation. She's sort of a come to Jesus moment in the graveyard when she sings Wishing You Were graveyard. Somehow Here Again, which we got to talk about that because yeah. it was such a beautiful and over the top scene and I loved it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough because she really isn't the main character of this. She's one of them. She's an important character. But the main character of this movie, I would argue, is the Phantom / the Opera House. Because I need to segue into the fact that this is a gothic romance.
Yeah.
And that I would imagine that this book was written as a gothic romance. I've never read the original book. But it hits all the marks of a gothic romance. Like setting as a character, like an enclosed cloistered space, aka the opera house. There's like a weird supernatural mystery sort of element, the Phantom doing all this weird shit around the opera house, and he's like, is he there, is he not, is he, what's going on? So there's this it's sort of supernatural element to it. And some of the themes in gothic literature, gothic stories, some of the hallmarks are like obsession, madness, like a general psychosis. And we kind of hit all of those. And the Phantom himself, he is the main character. I mean, he is the title character. It's called the Phantom of the Opera. But you kind of go into this and you get presented with Christine's point of view initially that like, you know, I can sing the title. You get sort of nominated to do stuff by other people. She's literally just reacting to other people telling her what to do. But yeah. The main character of this story is the Phantom. And we don't often get in a gothic story, we don't often get the point of view of the monster. It's always told from somebody else's point of view. So like when you think of gothic stories, one of the most important of all time is Frankenstein. But Frankenstein is told from the point of view of the doctor who created Frankenstein. It's like, oh shit, what have I done? But like, holy shit, I remember reading that in like college and thinking like, damn, I feel so fucking bad for this monster
yeah.
who's been cast out and is just like wandering the world. Like what a tragic, sad shit. And I mean, there are so many gothic stories, but there's always some sort of like monster element. And in the Phantom of the Opera, it's the main character really is the Phantom. And he's a total piece of shit in some ways. And he's like a haunted, weird, deformed person. Yeah. But you also garner some sympathy for him, which is also a hallmark of gothic stories. I love a good gothic romance because it's got its own sort of happy ever after, but it's always a little bit sad or majorly sad depending on like what the story is. And Phantom of the Opera really does it. So it's like, you know, if you're like a fan of like the Bly Manor or The Haunting of Hill House, it's kind of got that same melancholic feeling at the end. And it's got such a strong sense of place and setting where the setting is the character, the opera house. I think maybe people were just like weren't ready for that in 2003. I don't know. And I didn't really think about that until I was like rewatching this and thinking about this as an adult that like, oh my God, this is like a true gothic story. And the main character isn't Christine. She's literally just reacting to whatever's happening to her. The person driving the plot forward is the Phantom.
Yeah. I mean, the movie itself is so larger than life. And I went into this expecting that. We've talked about it a little bit over the last couple of weeks. We've been planning on watching it. I knew that it was directed by Joel Schumacher, and I'm pretty familiar with his body of work. He makes some, you know, and just really bold swings. And I love bold swings in movies. Even sometimes when they don't stick the landing, I respect the hustle. And I respect the unapologetic attempt. He did a movie in 1990 called Flatliners with Kevin Bacon and Julia Roberts. They were like biology students that had this, made this machine that would stop your heart, and then you could walk around as a ghost, and then you'd come back into your body. But and like it was a serious movie. It was like a horror movie, but it was just a wild idea. And so I knew going into this, I expected it to be larger than life and over the top, and I was not disappointed. But I can see if people, you know, this version, they added some things that were not in the original musical. And so I think probably the diehard theater kids were hurt because they're like, this is new shit. This is not my Phantom of the Opera. And then like mainstream audiences were probably hurt because like they were expecting something like Moulin Rouge, or they just thought it was so silly. They were like, I can't take this seriously.
Well, I don't know if audiences hated it because it made a bunch of money.
That's what I'm saying.
I think the critics didn't really quite know what to do with it. And, you know, I don't remember what era Moulin Rouge takes place in, but I mean, both are set in Paris. One of the things that I always find so funny about anything set in outside of the United States, I have to call this out for all movies, just everywhere, all the time ever made. The accent game is so confusing.
I know.
And Phantom of the Opera is guilty of this because it's supposed to be in Paris, early 1900s. We've got Patrick Wilson, who is an American, and he speaks in an American accent. He's also supposed to be a Viscount, the French version of a Viscount. I can't say the word, which is their like a ranking in the peerage. We've got Christine Daae, who is also an American. Her father is supposed to be like a Swedish violinist, but she's an American. She speaks in an American accent. We've got the Phantom, who doesn't really have any spoken lines, but
I think he has like 10.
It's very light.
Yeah.
But Gerard Butler is British. And then we've got some other folks, like Minnie Driver is British, but she doesn't have any, she's got a few spoken lines, but she's Italian. She plays an Italian diva in it. But like, it's kind of all over the place. There is one actor who really commits to the French bit, and that's Miranda Richardson. She's like Madame Ballet, and also sort of the deus ex machina of this. Like, she knows who the Phantom is. We get a sort of like weird added scene of her backstory with the Phantom, which like totally wasn't necessary, but like, yeah. All right, fair. Whatever,
it was
fine.
It was a little heavy-handed. It was a scene that showed the Phantom's kind of origin story, and I didn't really feel
in a freak show.
In a freak show.
He was like a freak show kid who was like abused, yeah, and she took compassion on him and hid him away.
Yeah, it shows this kid with a bag on his head while this circus wrangler is just like beating him with reeds. So we're like, all right, fine. I feel bad for him.
Meanwhile, he's like not even ugly.
It was like a shoehorn scene that was like, see, don't you feel bad for him?
Yeah.
But I did find this review that I think is worth a look at. The movie got 33%, which
haters
is not
don't
great.
Know.
So this says, too much of the film clung to the theater experience, which ultimately appears wildly ingenuine on the silver screen. Which is fascinating because the movie is a love letter to theater, to, you know, opera. There's this really cool montage at the beginning when everybody's, you know, getting ready and like the theater prep and all the makeup, everybody's running around. And if you're in a theater and you're like watching a movie about theater, it's like, yeah, this is great. But if you're just like watching a movie and like you don't really care that much about theater, you know, it's probably lost on a lot of people in that sense.
But I think to the casual movie viewer, it's not such a jarring experience. Like, I don't know. I think that it was critically panned in a way that was like perhaps not fair. And I don't say this because I just personally really like the movie. I've seen enough film adaptations of musicals to know like what the critics typically like, you know, and that's one that branches outside of its setting. When I think of like Into the Woods, or I think of Chicago, or I mean, what else originated on Broadway and was made in whatever. Like, those are the two that are coming to my memory right now. But those two, like, they go a lot grander. Well, and I mean in the setting sense, like, they were like, it doesn't have to just take place on like in one area, because that's one of the confines of the stage where you have to get creative on the stage. Is it like, okay, well, you literally have one stage. How can you make this look like a bunch of different places? Or how can you tell a story in a confined setting? And the Phantom of the Opera didn't really need to tackle that because it's a Gothic story, because the setting is is the character is the important part. It is. It takes place in an opera house. And for the Phantom, that's sort of its jail. And there's like cloistered, like suffocating effect, as is the case in any gothic storytelling. It doesn't matter if it's Manderley or it's wherever else. Like it's, you know, the location is just as important. And so it doesn't really need to venture outside of that. And we get a couple of scenes that are sort of outside of it. And I don't know. I know camp doesn't always translate to like critical acclaim, and the movie itself made like plenty of money. So it's like not a flop from a commercial perspective. But I hope that when somebody decides to let's reboot this and remake this, that they remember the like gothic nature of the story and they don't try to fucking do some weird shit with it, because that is part of the draw of such a tragic love story. Because we go to the movies for stories, right? Like we go
when the lights begin to dim.
Oh my God. The heartbreak feels good in a place like this, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Thank you, Nicole Kidman. Like we go to the movies for stories. And when you're going to a movie like Phantom of the Opera, you are looking for that dramatic arc that ends in happiness, but with like a twinge of heartbreak. And I don't know if you can do it in the same way if you don't pay close attention to your setting. And the opera house is so important to the setting. Like, I don't give a shit who's got what fucking accent. Honestly, like, it's kind of goofy when it doesn't all pan out. But, like, you know, we're all used to, like, the blanket British accent as, like, the European accent, quote unquote, for, like, all movies, film, and television. So if everybody's British, it doesn't matter. If you got a couple of Americans in there, who the fuck cares?
Yeah.
Like, just don't fuck with the setting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you don't like musical theater, you're not going to like this movie. If you don't like musicals, you're not going to like this movie.
I would argue that you might if you like gothic stories.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, if you're a, what's that dude's name that you love?
Mike Flanagan.
If you're a Mike Flanagan fan, you might actually really like Phantom of the Opera. You, I don't know, go into it knowing that there's singing involved, which, like, fine. But Mike Flanagan loves a gothic story. All of his Netflix shows, I didn't watch. The one that we didn't finish, I can guarantee you, was a gothic story because it was an Edgar Allan Poe thing. So there you go.
Yeah.
But you kind of got to go into this, like, they're going to sing at you.
Yeah.
So if you're down with that.
If you just go into it knowing that, like, if you can just, like, relax and just enjoy what you're seeing and don't question things and...
And appreciate the spectacle.
This movie is so big. So, like, the set pieces are pretty amazing. The opening, they show this, like, it's supposed to be more modern time. The auction of them, like, selling off different elements from the original opera house. And it's, like, a 1907.
Which I don't think that was the framing of the stage play. It has been so long that I literally can't remember.
Yeah, that was really strange.
I think that was like their way of trying to make it a little bit different. Like, I don't know if it was totally necessary.
Yeah, they're just like bridging. It reminded me of Bill Paxton in Titanic, how it starts and you get like side story of this guy and he's like,
did we need
fishing artifacts out of Titanic? And
maybe
then,
that's what they were inspired by.
I mean, they do like they show the rotten bow of the Titanic. And then it, like, transitions into, like, full color.
That's, like, literally like, what happened in this.
Yeah. Which, okay. They originally did that in Wizard of Oz. Like, that was,
okay.
Like, a transition place from one to the other. But it was weird because...
Did they do that in Moulin Rouge?
I don't
remember the opening of Moulin Rouge. That sounds like something Baz Luhrmann would do.
I'd watch Moulin Rouge.
So what I'm saying is we need to watch Moulin Rouge again. That's my next movie pick.
So...
Is it Elephant Love Medley? Fuck, I haven't seen that movie in so long.
Elephant Nedley.
Elephant Love Medley.
Oh, yeah. Moulin Rouge was really interesting because it was, you know, Baz Luhrmann and Joel Schumacher aren't so different, but in Moulin Rouge, they go above and beyond to the point where, like, the characters are talking to the camera and they're using pop songs that have, like, been kind of remade to fit the theme.
Yeah.
And like Phantom.
Lady Marmalade.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And like
the
masquerade scene of the Phantom of the opera is fantastic. And, you know, the title track of the musical is like pretty synth heavy, which of course doesn't fit the period. So I mean,
but
I love
so
that.
So dramatic.
Oh, it's fine. Yeah, it's not a criticism for me, but it's something that you notice. And so there's these places where like Moulin Rouge style and Phantom of the Opera style, like they kind of dip into where like I would say that Phantom of the Opera is stylish, where Moulin Rouge is stylized.
But it's important to note that Phantom of the Opera has been a musical since 1988. So I think Baz Luhrmann probably took a lot of inspiration from like opulence and grandeur of the like actual Broadway show for the Phantom of the Opera Broadway show for his, what he did with Moulin Rouge, because one existed before the other, quite literally. And I don't know if that's true, but I would imagine that it probably is in some way. Baz Luhrmann is such a visionary and he does such dreamy shit.
Yeah.
And, but his is also very tragic, you know?
Yeah.
Moulin Rouge is fucking sad.
Moulin Rouge is sad.
But oh my God, did it give me a huge crush on Ewan McGregor. Damn.
But so much of Elvis was such a big eye roll from me.
Well, yeah.
But that's fine.
Know,
we don't
gotta go there. There's
we don't have to go into there, but
there's a lot to roll your eyes at for that. But back to the Phantom of the Opera, let's talk about vocal performance, because that's a big selling point. We sort of mentioned this earlier, and God bless Gerard Butler for like trying his best here. He was sort of the Russell Crowe of the cast, but he wasn't like the full Russell Crowe. But I want to acknowledge how amazing Patrick Wilson is in this movie and how I'm so grateful that it launched his career. I know he's sort of like the Insidious guy now. He's sort of found a home in horror films, but he is such a fucking gifted singer. And
so much.
He has such a natural, beautiful ease. He was a Broadway actor and singer before they cast him in this movie as Raoul. And it's pretty obvious because he's like an effortlessly beautiful singer and he deserves his flowers for it. And it's always fascinating to me when people like, I think there's a new generation of people or people who just didn't see The Phantom of the Opera who see him in The Conjuring, or that's his kind of his series, his whatever. And then he's a great actor and he's handsome, but they don't know he's a great fucking singer. And so like every now and then like a TikTok or an Instagram post or like something will surface where he's singing something somewhere. People are like, oh my God, is that Patrick Wilson? And it's like, yeah. This is what the man did for a long time, and we love him for it.
Getting back to his roots.
He was also in Girls, which we just rewatched.
Yeah.
Which also really drove my passion to choose this movie for the podcast. But yeah, Patrick Wilson is a fucking star, and he's amazing in this. And Emmy Rossum did a great job, too. She was a tiny baby when she made this thing. She was like 17. And I do want to call out, okay, so this was something that I had to think about. I was like, okay, as is the case with a lot of older texts that were written long ago, or even not that long ago, we often have a situation where it's like presented as a romance, but it is grooming. It's actually grooming because the woman in question is but a girl.
Yeah.
She's only like actually like 15. And I was like, okay, is this like a grooming story? Is this a love story? Like, I don't remember. You know, when I watched this when I was 15 myself or 16 or whatever, that thought didn't really cross my mind. But I was like, okay, how old is Christine Daae in this story? As it's told, just in general. And the like general consensus is that Christine is 21. And I was like, oh my God, it's not a grooming story. Hey, she's legal. That's cool. And then I realized like, well, actually it is a grooming story because she moved into the opera house when she was a child. And the Phantom was like her angel of music and created a fucking mannequin as a bride of hers. But she doesn't end up with him, right? Spoiler alert, she doesn't end up with him because like that's madness and obsession. That's not true love. So that's cool that she's not underage when these two dudes are fighting over her.
We appreciate consent.
Yeah, we love consent. We love an adult woman. So that's nice. But yeah, it's, you know, the Phantom's love for her is not at all pure. It's an obsession. And obviously, because he's got a fucking mannequin of her in his grotto of
And he has some
candles.
Pretty self-destructive tendencies.
Yeah.
And he's got some
weirdo.
Anger management issues.
Yeah.
And you can't really watch this as a traditional three-act movie where you're like, oh, I hope she ends up with
the Phantom.
No, it's
a gothic romance.
I know, but like you're watching it on a TV screen, you know, a lot of people, like, they're not watching this as a musical. They're watching this, like, as a major motion picture movie.
But for the girls who love the villains, you can see why that's hot.
Oh, of course.
Like before you get the glimpse of the mannequin of the bride, you're like, I would totally be into it.
The bad boy.
Oh, the bad. Exactly. It's the bad boy versus the blonde boy.
Yeah.
As is, apparently it's like a tale as old as time. It truly is.
I mean, I love that Patrick Wilson wears white throughout the whole movie.
Yes.
And the Phantom wears black.
Until he wears red. We could talk about costuming.
Well, I do want to talk about the costuming is so great. It's so intentional. And there's the scene where she, after the graveyard.
The graveyard.
Yeah, we'll talk about the graveyard. But while we're on costumes. So after the graveyard scene, she is at like the penultimate choice of the movie. And Anna pointed out that she had this black dress and this white shirt that's very much like she's torn with her decisions. And it's just,
but
it's a.
That's before she goes on stage. And then she goes on stage and she's in white. And when she's in the lair, she's in the white.
Yeah.
When she's in the Phantom's lair.
So when she's at the graveyard, she's in black.
Yes.
But she's in mourning.
The costume changes kind of don't make sense because you're like, when did you change? Doesn't matter.
They don't always.
Whatever.
Not every costume is telling the story.
But it is. It is. But you also just like, you know, one of my favorite.
You're also like, ooh, she's in taupe. That symbolizes like, no.
Yeah.
Black and white. Let's keep it simple.
She really is in black and white. Occasionally she's in pink. But for the most part, Christine is in black and white. So yes, go ahead. Yeah.
So yeah, the graveyard scene, which was one of the scenes that was, I don't think that was in the
That song is in the musical. Wishing You Were Somehow Here Again is in the musical. I just don't remember how they how they did it on stage. It's one of my favorites. And it's such a delightful gothic romantic, sad. She's in the snow and it's in this like Parisian graveyard. She's going to see her father's grave and she's in all black and she's got this like lace mesh covering on her head.
They filmed it in an actual cemetery in Paris.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Well, we've seen some cemeteries in Paris. They kind of look like that. That tracks. I mean, the whole city of Paris kind of feels like that movie in general. So cool. I'm on board. And it's, that scene is just so, like, dramatic is the word.
It's just so fucking beautiful.
And it really is so beautiful.
It's got, like, Tim Burton vibes. It's also very Joel Schumacher.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, like, Batman Returns. There's so many different layers that are, you know, larger than life. I mean, there's, you know, we've all seen trees, but like you've never seen trees like this. And we've all seen gravestones, but you've never seen gravestones like this.
You've never seen them swirling in mist with snow.
Exactly.
And there's these like weeping angels and every, like you pointed out when we were watching, every single angel figure in the graveyard has their head covered. Like they've got like a covering on
like
their head.
Shroud over the top half of their face.
Exactly. And the Phantom, of course, is there because he's a fucking creep. And he takes over her carriage and drives her there. She doesn't know. And, but he's watching the whole thing. And like the Phantom has half his face covered, right? Because he's disfigured. So all these figures in the graveyard have their face covered. Then Raoul shows up, which shout out to Patrick Wilson for all of his stunt work because
he rides this horse bareback,
a white horse bareback. And I was like, that's the hottest thing I've ever seen in my life.
That's like straight back pocket romance cover from the 80s.
It really is. The bodice rippers.
Yeah.
But it is so good. And he looks so great doing it. And then there's like the little sword fight and there's and she's like holding a red rose and it's a whole thing. And it's great.
Yeah.
It's a great fucking scene.
It's a beautiful scene. But there's a lot of different set pieces where you just have to chill the fuck out and not ask too many questions. Like there's a scene where they go down into his lair.
In the beginning of the movie?
Are you talking about the movie?
Oh wait, I love this scene. It's so goofy.
It's great, but they're like unveiling his lair and like the lighting is, I mean, it's inappropriate lighting. Like it's so well lit. It's amazing. But there's candles. These candelabras come out of the water and they are magically lit and it's a cool effect.
Of the supernatural effect of like the gothic, like that's like there are things that happen in like a gothic story. I'm not saying that's normal or like
I'm not hating on it. I'm just saying like,
but that like totally tracks with the gothic setting of it all, that like this doesn't like there's like a supernatural element to stuff that doesn't necessarily need to like quote unquote make sense. Like
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But I want to call out how silly that scene is. So it's like to the beginning of the movie, Christine and the Phantom meet face to face for the first time ever. He's been her angel of music. So like AKA kind of like grooming her since she was a little kid in a, like, a weird way. Like we discovered that like there was like a one way mirror. He's been like watching her this whole time. So, oh, not cute. But we see him for the first time, and Hollywood is like, this man is ugly. And he is actually not at all ugly. It's Gerard Butler in his like late 20s with a half a mask on his face and some eyeliner on. He's not at all ugly. He really isn't. All of us are like, I could fix him.
Well, he's not supposed to be ugly with the mask on.
I know, but they're trying to tell us like, this is the man that you would like recoil from. And I'm like, yeah, no, like, ain't nobody recoiling from that. Yeah. Like, this has no Frankenstein, yeah.
What's
my
the
dude.
Opposite of recoil?
Frankenstein's monster. But anyway, there's a funny continuity error. It's not a continuity error so much as it is like just a movie reason situation. Where like when Christine and him meet, I think about this too much. And when they first meet face to face for the first time as adults, she's like fresh faced. She is in a white nightgown sort of thing with like a corset. And she is like rosy pink cheeks and like pink lips. And her hair is like half back because she's like done for the night. She's performed her aria. And the Phantom is like, okay. Then you get they touch hands and there's an incredible beat drop where the Phantom theme kicks in. It's the first time you hear it in the movie and it's awesome. And it's like, yeah, here we go. Phantom of the Opera. And he like is leading her down to the lair and they have their duet. And so she's kind of got this like mystified, like, oh my God, is this man? This is my angel of music, look on her face. But they like get, as they get deeper into the lair, her costuming kind of changes. And she goes from like nightgown to like, it's like got some sparkles. And then she suddenly got like a full beat on her face. Like she's got like a smoky eye. And then all of a sudden her hair, like he puts her on a black stallion bareback when she's like wearing a corset. And like back in those days, it would have been like pantaloon sort of things. Like she would have just been like bare crotch on the horse, but like whatever. And he like leads her into his like secret basement grotto, which is where the candles emerge and like light automatically. It's so goofy. But then like her hair is down and I'm like, oh, she went from like fresh face, innocent virgin in a white nightgown to like now she's got like a full smoky eye.
Yeah.
Her hair is down. And she's like, even as she gets out of the like gondola that he like brings her in, like you can see her stockings. And it's like the costuming is like gorgeous, but it's also kind of silly.
Yeah.
Which is why it's like campy. He's like singing to her and they're having their whole duet and they like go back and forth. And there's a couple of musical pieces that happen there. She does a great job, Emmy Rossum does, of like this like intoxication effect of this like mysterious man who's like singing his beautiful songs to you. And she's like, yeah, I'm into it. And you can like tell.
It's like she's transforming.
Yeah. And she's just got a shitload of smoky eyeshadow on her eyes. And it's like, okay, girl.
Yeah.
You didn't have that on a minute ago, but you know.
Yeah. I think it's dramatic enough. It's definitely not an accidental error.
Oh no. It was intentional.
It makes you wonder. I mean, it is like the transformation of a character.
It's a movie reason situation.
Yeah. Like, but if it would have been a more subtle, you might have thought maybe somebody didn't catch this in the filming. But I mean, there's tech people.
The producer was Andrew Lloyd Webber. So he's it makes sense. It's fine.
But I mean, like, there's tech people whose sole job is to make sure that continuity errors don't happen. So, like, it for sure wasn't an accident. But again, that's something else that maybe that was somebody's criticism. Maybe they didn't understand that it was intentional, or maybe, you know, it just, they chalked it up to silliness and it was a criticism for them. But I love how bold and unapologetic they were with their vision.
Yeah. You can tell that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Joel Schumacher like fully understood what the other one was trying to do and like what their mission and their vision was. And they fully committed to it and they like went for it. It worked really well. Like for like overall, this is a very cohesive movie. And everything from like, even, you know, I'm kind of like joking about like, oh, whoops, she's got a smoky eye. Like for the most part, like everything just makes sense together.
Yeah.
And there are for sure some situations where like, oh yeah, here it's happening because of movie reasons. Here it's happening because musical reasons. Like whatever. Who gives a fuck? Like, if you can suspend your disbelief.
You're watching a musical.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
Exactly. And also, but like, this is a little bit of fantasy. Like all movies are a little bit fantasy. Like we could talk about the Avengers and like all the weird shit they do forever. But this one has an element of supernatural. It's gothic. It's spooky. It's sad. It's romantic. It's beautiful. And they like, just, there are so many scenes that I was like, damn, that is so beautiful. When they sing, when Christine and Raoul are singing their duet, All I Ask of You, on the top of the opera house, and the Phantom is listening like the creepy fucking is. It is so beautiful. It's like light snow falling and she's wearing a red like velvety robe and her and Raoul are like pledging their love to each other. And there's these like gargoyles and angels like watching over them and like it's like a muted blue background because it's winter in Paris, and there's like the Paris in the background, and I was like, damn, no wonder I fucking love this as a 16-year-old.
This is the most romantic shit I've ever seen.
Yes, and also Patrick Wilson sings like a goddamn angel. Yeah. And like Emmy Rossum does too. So I'm like, yeah, this is great. And then you feel really bad for the Phantom because they go and like they finish their duet and they go inside and he's like, oh, and it's like very sad and tragic because he just like really wants to love her.
Yeah.
But I want to say real quick that when I was watching it tonight, I like was struck by the similarities between Beauty and the Beast, the original fairy tale, and this. And Beauty and the Beast has its own like love triangle, but she chooses the Beast because in the original fairy tale, Belle represents light and all that is good in the world. And so she chooses the Beast and he chooses her. And that is how they become whole. And Gaston could have given her a life if she wanted it, but he's sort of a dumb shit. But this was like sort of a, it kind of had Beauty and the Beast elements to it, even though the Beast doesn't end up with, the Beast, aka Phantom, doesn't end up with the Beauty. She chooses him because she is light and she is all that is good in the world. And that is often what women, like how they were represented and what they represented in texts from that time period and later and earlier, like Beauty and the Beast was. And it's interesting to see that like her kindness set her free. And that's sort of, that's how Beauty and the Beast like set her free. Her kindness set him free and her free. So the woman in these stories always had to fall on their sword and had to show the most intense and absolute kindness to whatever fucking thing was torturing them. And that was how the conflict was resolved. And I always find those stories really interesting. I don't dislike them. I actually really love Beauty and the Beast retellings. I don't really particularly have a problem with them. You could dissect them bit by bit if you wanted to. But there was definitely a Beauty and the Beast element to it.
For sure.
That I thought, I was like, oh, because he's obviously the Beast. And in this case, Gaston was not a dumb shit. Raoul was actually a pretty good dude who'd like wanted to treat her well and just like make her a countess, which is not a bad life.
Yeah. And obviously very much Hunchback of Notre Dame vibes.
Oh, yeah. Victor Hugo. Damn. What were the French on? They were such bummers. I'm grateful because I love sad shit like that. But like,
I mean the actual story, not the Disney version.
In the Disney version. Oh, that's an interesting thought.
He gets the girl in the Disney version.
No, he doesn't. Well, in the Disney version, all of them live.
Of course,
Phoebus,
yeah.
Esmeralda, and Quasimodo all live. And it's sort of implied that Quasimodo will be forever their third wheel. But in the book by Victor Hugo, at the very end, Esmeralda dies.
Yeah.
And the gravediggers dig up her grave and there is the skeleton of a deformed spine curled around her. So he never stopped loving her, which is very similar to how the movie Phantom of the Opera ends, which is Christine Daae is dead. Like, you know, we kind of talked about the time jumps and Raoul, her husband, she gets to be with him, goes to visit her grave, and there is a red rose, which is the Phantom's symbol, with her engagement ring he tried to give her that she accepted, but he let her go because she was so kind. It's next to her grave. That is so Hunchback of Notre Dame coded.
I just don't like the ending.
You didn't like the ending? I did. I like that he got to keep going. I like that he got to live.
I like that he got to live. I just wanted her to choose Patrick Wilson.
She got to be with him.
Like, unequivocally. But, like, she kind of chose
the Phantom so that Patrick Wilson could live. It was a selfless act.
Yeah.
She chose the Phantom because he told her in his, like, sing-song voice, if you choose me...
If you don't choose me, I'll kill him.
Literally, that's what he told her. He was like, if you choose... Like, so she was truly stuck between a rock and a hard place.
So, like, again, she's got no agency.
Totally. Women have, she has no agency in this. She has one choice to make. And it's like, do you kill
make the wrong choice or kill this guy?
Yeah. Which bad choice do you want to make?
Yeah.
And she chooses the Phantom so that Raoul will live. Yeah. And he lets her go because
the Phantom's like, oh boy, she chose me.
What does she sing song to him? She's like, something, the creature of darkness. What kind of life have you known? Something like, let me the patience to show you what love is. And then she kisses him. She chooses him so that Raoul will get to live. And then he feels so fucking bad that he's like, just go. And
just seems like they all lost.
Well, yeah, that's that's a but gothic that's romance. That's the tragedy. That's yeah, the tragedy yeah. of a gothic romance. Yeah. It's like there's sort of a happy ever after. They're like Christine and Raoul got to live their life together, but it's actually not that happy of an ending.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Who knows what the fuck happened to the Phantom? Well, clearly he's still around. He's dropping roses at her grave.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the other criticisms that I was expecting, I didn't go in with my arms crossed. I went in like really wanting to like it. And I did. I really liked it a lot. But like some of the criticisms were just like technical 2004 things. You know, like the events of the movie, the bulk of the events take place in like 1880. And then like the auction is taking place in like 1907. And so Patrick Wilson during the bulk of the movie is like 35, 40 years old.
And then like suddenly ancient.
And then like 25 years later in the auction, he's like 85. And they do this weird, like old timey film grain.
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive.
And I know
for
that
sure.
they're doing it to like separate the time frames, but like I've never seen a movie where the old timey film grain is now. And okay. like the beautiful 4K opulence is like 40 years ago.
Totally valid. There's also
but it's
some
not
complaints.
I mean, fucking whatever. I mean,
it's
like
a little they. I know they did that to like differentiate between the two timelines, but yeah, it's weird. Like when you get the black and white, and I think maybe what they were trying to represent there that like didn't quite come across was that without Christine, the world was very black and white for him.
Yeah, yeah, and which, like to like, go from okay. that film grain, like this. There's a scene at the beginning. They have the auction, and it's all grainy and like smoky and black and white, and then they take the curtain off of the chandelier, and then it does this like beautiful like pan dolly shot of the opera, and it like fades to color, and it makes it so much more powerful.
It's so Titanic.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
It makes it so much more powerful, not just because the opera is so beautiful, but like we've been in this ugly like film grain world for
you
10
saw
minutes.
What happened to it after that night, and yeah. it's kind of cool because you like I love a story that starts at the end and then goes back
for
to
sure.
the beginning. I do, but that's just me personally. Fair point, though. I also want to point out that sometimes the sound editing on this was like really goofy.
Yeah, we had our sound bar all the way up to 100.
Well, I just think it's because this movie came out in 2004 and probably hasn't been remastered for like updated sound. But I mean, like when characters are talking versus when they're singing, it's a little bit jarring sometimes. Like they didn't do it live. Tom Hooper famously did Les Mis.
Fuck it, let's do it live.
Well, fuck it. It was very fuck it, let's do it live. Tom Hooper with Les Mis was like that. He had all of his actors sing live.
He learned.
He probably learned from Phantom that like it just didn't quite translate as well. But it also, poor Russell Crowe, again, like couldn't compete with the other actors who were like trained to sing and like had a better vocal ability than he did. But it was more natural in general. And I say this as somebody who watches Les Mis like a couple times a year and then just like sits there and cries for a while.
Yeah.
But Phantom, it was, and I, which I haven't watched in a long time. And I was like, oh, weird. Like you can feel the track shift. Like here we are. We got two people talking on with boom mics. And then it's like, oop, singing. And it just like feels very different.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they're in a sound booth.
Yeah. That the only time I really noticed is when they were on the rooftop. And now they would, the sound technology has gotten a lot more so that even if they recorded in a sound booth, they would have put some atmospheric layers over it. And this one, they're on the roof and it's like snowing and they're like 200 feet up in the air. Yeah. And the sound, it's like they're in a sound booth.
They would have just edited that together a lot better.
Yeah. And
but
then
I
like
think
some
it,
clunky,
it's a sign of the times
for sure.
sort of a
like,
situation.
There's some clunky cinematography things where like some really bold camera shots that were just like, no, that one didn't work.
There's also some really beautiful camera shots that
there
we feel
are.
Like we should call out that like there's a couple of flops in the movie, like ones that it's like
That weird David Fincher shot where it goes down into the floor. It's like, no, just cut to.
Yeah. But there are also some really, especially in the Phantom's lair and his like weird
oh my
basement
God.
Grotto.
I wanna live in that lair.
They, I know, I'm like,
swimming
actually,
pool.
I would have stayed. He's actually pretty hot and this looks great.
Just
you
keep
got
that
a
mask
pool.
On, bub.
Yeah, I'm down with it. It's fine. I can fix him. I can understand why she would have stayed.
Yeah.
But like there are so many great shots with like mirrors and candles where you are like the character and the actor is framed in a way that like it's so intentional, but it remains very opulent and key to the vision. It doesn't seem obvious. It just like I was watching it this time thinking like watching for this stuff. And I was like, yeah, fuck yeah. That's a good shot. That's a good shot. That's mm-hmm. a good shot. That's a good shot. Great, yeah. great.
I mean, and the sets were so beautiful that it's like, they film themselves. Just put the camera and like show us what you have.
Yeah, the sets were gorgeous.
You know who turned down the role of Christine?
Who?
Anne Hathaway.
Oh, that's right, because the scheduling conflicts. And they had initially talked to a couple of different actors to be the Phantom, and one of them was Hugh Jackman, which would have been a stellar choice.
And the
but
other
he
one
did not have time.
And
he
the other one
conflicts.
That was offered and took it, but eventually had to back out was Antonio Banderas.
That would have been so hot.
That would have been.
Can you imagine? Oh my God. Yeah, there were a number of different people that were in talks to play, because they hit Angela Lloyd Webber and Joel Schumacher had tried to make that movie for like 14 years where they finally got it done. And, you know, it is what it is. But Jackman would have been my ideal Phantom. But then we wouldn't have gotten him as Jean Valjean in Les Mis. And he was fucking heartbreaking in Les Mis. He is so fucking good as Jean Valjean. And he carries that whole movie. I mean, the whole cast is great, except for maybe Russell Crowe. I didn't mean this to turn into a Russell Crowe hater podcast, but he really carries Les Mis as a whole.
You know who would have been a great Phantom?
Who?
Russell Crowe.
Just screaming at Christine the whole time. You have come here.
I wanted to look up some of the different adaptations of the Phantom of the Opera for film specifically, and there's over 20. It's unbelievable. Incarnations. But one from 1989 that is stars...
That's a year after it hit Broadway. That's crazy.
And it stars Robert Englund, who played Freddy Krueger. And
it's not my Phantom.
So the Nightmare on Elm Street movies were still going on well into the 90s, but this was in 1989, and the tagline for this movie is called Phantom of the Opera, the motion picture, which fucking awesome title.
I want to know how did they get the rights for it?
Because I'm sure it's not musical.
It must not be a musical, because at that point, Andrew Lloyd Webber would have held the rights to the musical.
Because Andrew Lloyd Webber is nowhere in the credits, but the tagline is, was Freddy, now he's the Phantom of the Opera. Like, any tagline that incorporates another character that actor was is so ridiculous.
That's embarrassing. It's interesting to me that, like, this story, I think it's just a testament to the power of a gothic story. All love, and we don't really have a ton of them. There are some, like, really iconic ones that have stood the test of time. And we've had some new ones come out, like Saltburn. It's a great gothic story, but of recent years, and we get them periodically, but it is a tough genre for people to write in a contemporary setting. And so a lot of people just redo the greats of the early 1900s and late 1800s, because the birth of the Gothic story was really with Mary Shelley, with Frankenstein.
What year do you think the first movie adaptation of The Phantom of the Opera was?
It was probably before the musical.
There's been, like I said, there's been over 20, probably closer to 30. And some of them are short films.
How interesting.
But the first full-length one.
This was a French novel, so I'm sure the French have tried it a few times.
So, but guess
the French
guess
novel
year?
Was in like 1910, I think, so maybe probably like 1930.
1925.
Damn.
With Lon Chaney as the Phantom.
It would be interesting to see... I'm sure it's not far off. The Phantom of the Opera reboot. Someone's going to do it.
But it would have to be like Change for the Ages, which would be tragic.
Yeah, I know.
It would be an A24 starring Sydney Sweeney as Christine.
Well, I mean, whoever it is has got to be able to sing. That's the tricky part.
We can get them there.
Or they would do a vocal dub. But I think now the demand of Hollywood actors is like, you can't have a vocal dub. You got to do it all yourself. And the role of Christine is very hard to sing, because it's like, part of it is she's like an opera singer, and then part of it she's like maybe gonna fuck the Phantom. And I do want to just say one of the reasons why I really like this musical is it is so horny.
Everyone's trying to fuck.
And like the Phantom and her, they have that point of no return thing, mm-hmm. when he like writes the opera and he like surprises her on stage, and I was like, damn, this is so hot. Good for them.
Yeah.
But he only gets a kiss from her and then he lets her go, and it's so fucking sad. So is this like Beauty and the Beast? If the Beast was like, she like kisses him and she turns him into a human, and then he's like, actually, you can go. Oh my God. Yeah. I would be so fucking bummed.
Yeah. It made me realize how much of a sucker I am for happy endings.
You need Raoul some sort kill. Of happiness.
I wouldn't want Raoul to kill
right,
the Phantom.
That would have disrupted his light and his innocence.
Well, yeah,
he was
but
a,
I want her to come to her own aid.
She kind of does.
The whole movie, she doesn't make a choice, and then finally Raoul kills the Phantom, and it's like, well, I guess that makes my choice.
She kind of gets to come to her own aid, but she, like you said earlier, like she doesn't really get a choice. She's just
being like torn in both directions.
But that's an interesting, this is sort of a women written by men predicament.
Yeah. I mean, know? She's just kind of a damsel.
She's a total damsel.
But I mean, that's like, that's another one of those tales all this times. Like Princess Leia wasn't really a strong character in the beginning. Like she doesn't
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, we won't get super into this, but like, you know, when I was growing up, one of the reasons I loved Alien was because I was like, this bitch is making choices. Like she
is
doing things. Ripley
is killing everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Leia relies on somebody to get her out of this jail. And then she relies on somebody, you know, like I know that she's not like helpless.
That's valid. It's been a long time since I watched the original Star Wars movies, but that's a common issue that I have when I read a lot of books, as you know, is that there are women written by men are often just reacting to the world around them.
Yeah.
And they're not like actively, like they might be able to make a choice, but it's a choice where something has happened to them and they only can choose one way,
yeah.
You know?
So it's really not even a choice in that matter.
That's just how it fucking went for a long time. And now that it's changed, we have stories where women get to make choices that are not an immediate reaction to what is currently happening to them. They get to drive the plot forward. But that's a good point about Princess Leia. I haven't watched, I would like to rewatch this and think like, huh, from like a critical lens, like what does she?
She holds a gun, but I mean, that does not a strong female character make.
Yeah, not necessarily. I've watched Alien enough recently that I could, yeah, Ripley fucking.
I mean,
like,
she wasn't the first one, but growing up, that was the first one that I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, valid.
You are not waiting for a man, bitch. You are taking things into your hands.
Neither is Xena Warrior Princess.
That's a good point.
Or either witch from Wicked.
Yeah. I mean,
they save each other.
That's a female driven story.
They save each other. It's just like top of mind because Ariana and all of her bullshit.
Yeah.
She's doing right now.
When we were talking about the black and white to color transition, it reminded me of this thing that I just heard recently in The Wizard of Oz, the scene where the whole like first 20 minutes is in like sepia. And this after the house lands and Dorothy walks out. It's like sepia, and then she opens the door, and it's all just color. And the way that they made that was the whole interior house set was all sepia, and Judy Garland's stunt double was in a sepia dress. And so the stunt double opens the door and then ducks out, and then Judy Garland walks out in her blue dress.
Beautiful.
And it's like, 1935? What? That's fucking crazy.
Gorgeous.
Anyway. Yeah, this was a super fun movie. I didn't plan to, nor do I want to run down my, I didn't like this. This was a silly, like all of my criticisms are just like technical, you know, things that if you go back and look at other movies from 2004,
it's a totally
it's gonna
enjoyable
be
movie experience.
It's so watchable.
And it's so much fun to watch. It's beautiful to watch. If you like musicals, you've probably already seen this movie. If you are on the fence
if
about
you're
musicals,
listening to this, hopefully you've seen the movie. We've spoiled
yeah, we
it.
Well, I mean, it's
you had
okay.
20 years to watch it.
For the IP has been in existence for over 100 years. So at this point, it's the spoiler alerts don't matter. But I just want to end on the note that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Joel Schumacher did a fantastic job with this movie. They really committed to it. It might be cheesy at times. It is full camp in the best possible way. But Andrew Lloyd Webber was also responsible for Cats. And as we mentioned earlier, that adaptation was fucking bonkers. And
but the music for Cats is...
Cats is great.
Amazing.
And this whole ballad memory is just about like a cat wanting to be petted. It's very sad. And as
Mr.
a mother of two cats, it's super sad. But Tom Hooper did Cats, the adaptation, the film adaptation, which was Animorphs, the movie.
Another
and
bold swing.
It was bizarre as fuck, and I look forward to watching that when I like take an edible someday. I just like need to not be of this earth to like be a part of that. I really do look forward to it.
People.
No, I'm very excited about it. But Tom Hooper also did Les Mis. So what the fuck happened? Because Les Mis is beautiful.
Well, I think Tom Hooper knew to an extent what he was getting into with Cats. I mean,
Why did he give Rebel Wilson 8 nipples? 8 chichis.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that Idris also had 8 chichis, as did the Dame Judi Dench.
Just bizarre. Put them in costumes. Anyway.
So bizarre. Anyway, this movie is great. If it's been a while since you've rewatched it, I'm here to tell you it is definitely worth a rewatch. It stands the test of time.
It's cheap to rent. It's like $4.
It's $4 on Amazon.
Hey, listen, if you remember Emmy Rossum's solo album that came out after this movie, I want you to find me on Instagram and DM me, because that is a deep, deep, deep internet cut.
What?
And that is, if you happen to remember it, if you know it, you need to find me, because I remember and I listened to the fuck out of that album.
Oh my God.
I don't even think it's streaming anywhere anymore. It might be still.
She had 2 albums.
Okay, well, I remember the first one very well. Their beautiful curly hair. Inside Out. That's it.
Yeah.
Look at how beautiful she was. I mean, she still is. So if you listen to this and you remember Emmy Rossum's album, which had this like sort of Imogen Heap quality to it, you can find me on Instagram. I'm Anna H. Author. A-N-A-H Author. DM me about it. It's a fucking... I love that album. It's got a weird special place in my heart. I'll never forget it.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast, wife, and
your angel of music.
My angel of music. Think of me.
Think of me. Think of me fondly. Yeah, I'm gonna sing this shit to him for the next few weeks until I forget about it.
Sounds great. I can't wait. You can catch all of our podcasts at soundcloud.com/movieshowtheater. You can find us on Stitcher, Apple Music, anywhere you get your podcasts, and you can find our Facebook page, our Instagram. Send us a message and give us an idea of what to do, because we'll never run out of movies, but we want to talk about what you want us to talk about.
I'm full of ideas. She doesn't always like them.
She is so full of ideas. So we'll see what we come up with next. And until then, I'm Jimmy.
I'm Anna.
And this is Movie Show Theater.
Stay movies, everybody.